Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for those who are finally pregnant and parenting after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying with multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which sadly included pregnancy loss, I became finally pregnant in 2018, and I'm now finally parenting my gorgeous daughter, Ren. This season of the Finally Pregnant podcast is sponsored by Tomorrow Life Sciences. Ever wondered how and where your frozen eggs and embryos are stored? They are kept in tanks called dewars. Inside each tank, hundreds of eggs and embryos are submerged in liquid nitrogen. They're identified with tiny handwritten or printed labels, and the clinic manages and monitors them manually. This part of the IVF lab hasn't been updated in decades and also hasn't benefited from technology or innovation. That's where life sciences company Tomorrow comes in. Tomorrow has created the world's first and only automated platform for the management, identification, and storage of frozen human eggs and embryos. What does this mean? Tomorrow's technology replaces handwritten labels with sophisticated digital tracking, which creates an unbreakable digital link between the specimens and the patient. It also automates a huge part of the process, vastly reducing the risk of mistakes and human error. Finally, it monitors the safety of those frozen eggs and embryos 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Tomorrow's state-of-the-art technology gives patients and clinics peace of mind that those precious, irreplaceable frozen eggs and embryos are safe and protected. Tomorrow is being rapidly adopted by a host of clinics across the United States, creating a new and improved standard of care, and will be available in clinics in the UK this year. To find out more, visit tmrw.org. Links in the show notes. Hello there, how are you doing? Before we head into today's chat, I want to go a little deeper into some of the support I offer because, as you'll hear my guests say, we don't heal alone, we need community. You'll also hear her share how going to her first support group was scary. Now, she is referencing a support group for people who are bipolar, but I know there is a huge stigma around support groups in general. And I know I have referred previously to, you know, kind of picturing support groups as brown, dreary places with like felt tiles on the floor and uncomfortable metal plastic chairs kind of thing, you know? But what I want to do is break that stigma and tell you about the first support group that I ever went to. It was in a pub in South London, probably one of the only times I've actually ventured south. I'm a North London gal. But anyway, highly irrelevant. I met people there, you know, and that was like 5 years ago. And I'm in touch with a lot of them still today. You know, we've been through so much together since that kind of, yeah, just random, it felt like, evening. The bond we form with others who have or are going through similar things to us can be incredible. And not only that, but they can actually be pivotal in our lives and how we experience things. Can you tell I'm a total convert and complete fan to support groups? I was nervous too, like going into that first one, I was totally nervous. So whether you are trying to conceive, finally pregnant, or dealing with anything we discuss in this upcoming conversation, or anything else, to be honest, but today we particularly cover kind of mental health issues and termination for medical reasons, please, please, please seek out support and people who get you, whether it's a friend or family member or partner, which I know that doesn't always present itself, does it? In our kind of existing networks, perhaps. A counsellor, which, as you know, if you are a regular listener, I'm a huge advocate of, but can be expensive. You know, I kind of tend to dip in and out when I can afford it and when I really need it. But specifically, I guess, if you are finally pregnant or parenting, please remember that I run support groups. They are not only not brown and uncomfortable, mostly because you are joining from the comfort of your own home, which seems to be working well, you know, and has been for the last few years, because this has been going on kind of pre-COVID, actually. But people join from their sofas, from their beds, just, you know, like from the comfort of your own home is the point. And they're really accessible, I like to think, financially, because they are only $9.99 a month. Now, that's not just for the support group, just to make that clear. You do get access to lots of other resources too. If you have any questions or concerns, please drop me a line. You know, like, I want you to know that there is a space where you can talk and you can share your story and you can, you know, as my guest today talks about, you know, there's hope and grief all live together. You know, like, we're not just feeling one emotion at a time, and they are a place to celebrate the wins and talk about the challenges, which you might not have that space anywhere else. So I want to make sure that you know it's there. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking in a second. If you want to know more, you can head to my website thecatstrawbridge.com/thehangout, or there will be a link in the show notes. If you want to have a chat with me, you know, and talk about them or talk about the other support that I offer, then please, please do. You know, you're so welcome. Again, I'll pop a link to a free 15-minute call in the show notes. We can jump on a call together and talk about, you know, what there is for you and how I can support you. Or if I haven't got something that can support you, then I will signpost you to support that might be available to you. So yeah, support groups, just if you can, try to take the stigma out of it. Try to recognize that they're not scary and they are full of like normal people just like you. And you'll hear my guest talk about her experience. Like I say, it's about something different, but you know how transformative that has been for her. But right, I'll get down off my high horse about talking and community and support groups and all of that, because I really want to introduce this week's guest who kind of raised this topic, which I'm really grateful that she did. Her name is Emma Bell. Now, Emma is a podcast host herself, actually, and amongst many other things, she is an advocate for Bipolar UK, having been diagnosed with a condition herself 11 years ago. Whilst living with and managing her condition, Emma and her other half, Gareth, have spent the last few years trying to conceive. And as you'll hear, they have been through a lot, which has included fertility treatment, a miscarriage. And in 2021, they had to make the really difficult decision, like, I question, is it a decision, to terminate their pregnancy, which meant losing their daughter, Willow. As you will hear, Emma is now finally pregnant, but managing everything over the years has certainly not been easy. And yeah, being finally pregnant, as we talk about, having all of the hormones, the emotions, dealing with like big stuff whilst managing her condition is a lot. And so I think that you will find this a really interesting conversation, and most importantly, perhaps, a really inspiring conversation. If you are dealing with any of the issues discussed, please make sure you reach out for support. There are links in the show notes to Bipolar UK, and also so that you can find out more about Emma and the work that she does. But if you need something and you can't find it, then come to me and I will do what I can to signpost you elsewhere too, or support you myself, as I mentioned. But anyway, enough. That's it from me. I really hope that you enjoy our chat. Take care. Bye-bye. Before we head into today's chat, I want to remind you just how important it can be to talk and share our stories with people who get it. That's just one of the reasons I created this very podcast. And you already know how important that is, because you're here to listen to people whose experiences you relate to. But I want to give everyone the opportunity to talk, and that is just one of the reasons I launched The Hangout, a community specifically for those who are finally pregnant and parenting after infertility and loss. When you join, you'll receive a free meditation, access to a 24/7 community, invitations to exclusive live podcast recordings with experts across all areas of pregnancy and parenting, a full and growing resource library, support groups, discounts, and more. Find out more at catstrawbridge.com. I look forward to seeing you there soon. Hi there, Emma. How are you doing?
Today, I'm doing all right, actually, as it goes. Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, that's really, really, really good to hear. And I really appreciate you joining me today to share your story, which is one that brings you to being finally pregnant right now. Isn't that right?
Certainly is. Can't quite believe it myself. But yeah, I'm 21 weeks today.
That is amazing. But it has taken, like so many people I speak to for the podcast and outside of the podcast as well, it's taken a lot for you to get here. And
it has.
I know that it's a difficult thing to ask, but if you could kind of just talk us through that, I say briefly.
Sure.
Hate saying that.
I know. The highlights or the lowlights, I'm never sure which is the way to go. Bullet points maybe, who knows. But for me, I found out that I had a diagnosis of diminished ovarian reserve when I was about 34, 35, when I went to go and get my eggs frozen. And I got a shock to find out that I actually had a fertility issue going on. And I was told that I'd need 3 rounds of stimulation and retrieval to get about 10 eggs. And I didn't have a spare $30,000 lying around at the time, which is what it would have cost me because I was in Switzerland. So I decided that I would just have to wait because we weren't ready to start a family and see what happened when we were. I don't think I really understood the full gravity of what they were telling me, honestly, also. So anyway, fast forward to when I was 38, we were ready to start a family. We went straight down to the fertility clinic. They said, right, you go on these supplements, do 12 weeks. And I had all my levels tested again. They were worse as I anticipated. And my husband was told his sperm was amazing. And we started. So we did an ovulation induction, but fully medicated. So Clomid, gonoleth, and then trigger shot. Got pregnant and then had a loss at 5.5 weeks. And yeah, I mean, we were sad and it was our first round and you've got more stamina in you at that point, haven't you? there's more juice in the tank. So, you know, it was sad and it was disappointing, but it wasn't shattering for us. We were like, right, let's just go again. You know, we were in that stage. It was our first round. We couldn't believe we got a positive anyway. And whatever. So then we did 2 more rounds of ovulation induction, failed. Then we got told there was a 5% increased chance of conception with IUI. So we did that, failed. So by that point, we'd done 4. And then we changed clinics, changed doctors. The protocol was changed because she said it wasn't precise enough. And we did that and got pregnant with Willow. And because we'd had that early loss, I was terrified of miscarriage and missed miscarriage. So I spent the whole time anxious, barely able to sleep, checking the toilet paper, you know, all the things that you do, like a complete loony shit.
You'll be surrounded by people here too, like hands up.
Yeah, like, you know, like just so worried after that positive. And then when I didn't bleed, you know, up until 8 weeks, I was thinking, wow, you know, it's amazing. Then I started having bleeding between 8 and 11 weeks. So I was having a scan every week. And that was because I can never say it, a subchorionic hematoma or something. Anyway, that can happen behind implantation. That cleared up on its own and went in for a scan. They said, it's all fine. Everything's fine. Got to 12 weeks, couldn't believe it. Thought, that's it. We've graduated from stress land. And because I was over 35, I'd had the NIPT as just kind of standard. Didn't really understand what it meant, honestly. I thought I was just excited to know the sex of the baby. And then we went for our NT scan at 12.5 weeks and found out that the NT measurement was 6.5. Our baby had a cystic hygroma on her head, across her neck, across her chest, fluid everywhere. And I was told that, sadly, she was likely to pass inside me by the time I was 28 weeks. Or if she did make it to birth, she'd only live hours or days. So my choices weren't really if she was going to die. It was just kind of when. So we had to make the decision, do we carry on and wait? Or do we hope for a miracle and just then watch her pass? Or do we bring the pregnancy to an end? So we decided to have a termination for medical reasons. We also had the pressure of infertility and our doctor saying, you don't have long, you really do need to try again. We don't have any living children. If you want to have living children in your life, maybe waiting for your timeline might not be what you want because it might take away your chance of ever having living children. So it's something we had to consider. So we flew back to the UK and said goodbye to our daughter Willow at just under 14 weeks. Which was heartbreaking, honestly. It completely rocked my world as I knew it. And then afterwards, I sadly developed mild Asherman's syndrome as a result of the procedure, which took 6 months and two hysteroscopies to clear up.
And for people who don't know what Asherman's is, it's scarring of the lining.
Yeah, it's like where the womb lining starts to stick together. Mm-hmm. And it can stop your womb lining getting as thick as it needs to. So mine went right down to like 2 millimeters at the point where it should have been 8, you know, where it should have been at implantation, and it just wasn't getting there. I was having like this intermittent bleeding, and which was a result of the D&E, but so it can happen. So the impact of loss can carry on physically and emotionally, and then stall your plans, you know, further, because you then have to wait for your body to physically recover as well. So yeah, I had 2 hysteroscopies to finally clear it up. And then we moved to IVF because we wanted to, well, one, we'd done 5 rounds and 2 losses later, this is where we're at. And we also wanted to do PGTA testing for the embryos because Willow was diagnosed with Edwards syndrome. So we wanted to do that testing so that we could eliminate as much risk as possible of future losses. So we did IVF. I got the book, It Starts with the Egg. I did all the things. And our first round, they were told me I'd only get 2 or 3 eggs per round. So my first round, I got 2 eggs, 1 fertilized, made it to day 3, and then it arrested on day 4, day 5. So no blastocyst embryos.
Gosh.
And because of diminished ovarian reserve, we decided we would do 3 back-to-back rounds of IVF egg retrieval, which I knew would be hard on me. But I thought, let's just get it done.
Yeah.
Like 3 months on the trot was the plan. So we did our first one. I was really upset, but then I thought I was already getting my prep because I was about to go into another retrieval straight away. The second round, we got 8 eggs. So wow. We thought, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And that was a direct result of the changes that we'd made from that book, by the way. So we thought, this is amazing. We're bound to get at least 1 blastocyst embryo. Anyway, so we did, I think, 6 out of those 8 eggs were mature, 3 fertilized, and none of them made them to blastocyst embryo again. So we had nothing.
And that is something, like, I know that this isn't necessarily what this podcast kind of talks about, but for those going through fertility treatment, not getting anything to transfer back is something that kind of doesn't come up until it comes up. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, it's mm-hmm. you think, right, I'm having IVF. Well, first of all, my thought was, I'm having IVF. Yay, I'm going to have a baby. And then I realized that
mine was, yay, I'm going to have twins.
Well,
that's what I thought. I'm going to have IVF. I'm going to have twins. Job done.
Done.
I mean,
yeah, but getting to the stage where you, yeah, have done all the drugs, have collected the eggs, you know, sometimes it stops there. Sometimes it's they fertilize, but you don't have anything to transfer. Like, that's just like so much of this is grief. And that
yes.
in itself is just like such a huge kind of shock and grief. And now this has happened to you 2 months in a row. So that's yeah. a lot.
Yeah. And it was honestly after that second round, where we got no blastocyst embryos and they all arrested or degenerated day 4, day 5, it felt like losing Willow all over again. It was just such a hopeless space. It's like I was looking down the tunnel for it and I was seeing a tiny light of hope and it just got extinguished because I thought, right, you know, the only baby that we've genetically created together and we lost her and now we might not get to do that again. And that was a huge, like, compounded grief blow for sure. It's like a tidal wave and I felt like I was drowning. And we went in for our WTF appointment and yeah. I was confronted with, you know, you need to look at donor eggs, which is another whole layer of grief in itself when you have to start working through closing the door on your genetics, possibly. Especially with us, we were like, oh, well, we had a baby and we said goodbye to that baby. And now that might be the only baby we ever get to genetically create together. So it was a lot of loss. But anyway, somebody had been following our story on Instagram, and she's in a same-sex relationship, British but living in Spain, and she had used a sperm donor to have her daughter. And she sent me a message. I don't know her. She sent me a message and she said, I know you're probably not in the right space to hear this now, but if and when you are, I would like to offer to be your egg donor, because I wouldn't have been able to have my family unless someone had offered that to me. And I would love to be able to give back into this space. And I've been following your journey for a while. She had the same skin color, hair color as me. She was British, same eye color. She was like a real perfect match. And we're still in contact now, and she's incredible. And we started the process. So we booked in the consultations. She had hers, we had ours. We were literally ready to push the button and go. We were going to fly back to the UK and actually do it. And then somebody else who I connected with on Instagram, Zara, Little Norfolk Cottage, sent me a message and she said, Emma, I know that you're at the end of your kind of journey with your own eggs and all of this. Has Gareth had a DNA sperm fragmentation test? Now, at this point, he's had over 10 regular sperm analyses. He's been told his sperm's amazing. Now, you try telling a man his sperm's amazing and then telling him he needs another test, right? Luckily, Gareth's quite open, but I know it's difficult for some people. So I said to him, before we close the door on my genetics, I need to know that we've turned over every stone. I have to be sure, because this is, I'm closing the door on something mega here, right? Which I'm willing to do because I want to parent living children. I'm willing to find a way. I'm willing to look into other avenues to parenthood, but I've got to be sure I've done everything I can. So we did. And his sperm came back 40% fragmented, which put him in the male infertility category and low chance of IVF success. Yeah. Yes. So a mega, mega piece of the puzzle. So we then booked him with Dr. Ramsey in London, did a full suite of tests on him. I then looked into clinics in London and I said to him, let's just try one last time. Let's find out what the cause of this fragmentation is, treat it, see if we can get it low, because I'm not doing another round of IVF if one of the variables hasn't changed, because we're just doing the same thing, hoping for a different result. Yeah. It's pointless. One of these components has to change for us to have the chance of a different outcome. It has to. Got in with Melanie Brown. We both did a 12-week prep. First time he's ever done a proper 12-week prep. We got told it was 76 days to create new sperm, 90 days to create new eggs, which I already knew, but we didn't know about the sperm. So that's what we did. We gave it everything we had. We lived a very boring life for about 12 weeks. I mean, it was dull as dishwater and we really weren't each other's fans, but we did it. And his sperm DNA frag came down to 4%.
Wow.
Which put him in the very fertile category and a very high chance of IVF success. So we then went and did our final round at the end of December 2021 and had our best round yet. Got 9 eggs, 8 were mature, 4 or 5, I can't remember, fertilized. 2 made it to blastocyst. First time we've ever got blastocyst embryos. Both got sent off for genetic testing. 1 came back normal and was in the freezer in London. And we then flew back to Dubai because we were waiting for which is where we live. Mm-hmm. And we were waiting for the results to come back and letting my body settle down and then starting to prep for a frozen embryo transfer in March. And the very next ovulation, I see an acupuncturist and have been for a year, all as part of IVF prep. And every time she comes, if I'm due to bleed, she'll say, make sure you're not pregnant, because if you are, I don't want to give you needles that make you bleed, because that would just be ridiculous, right? Seeing as you're trying to get pregnant. So, and I do it every month, and every month it's negative. So it's not something I tell anyone about. I just do it. It annoys me. And it was the first month that I didn't buy a digital test because I thought it's a waste of money. Every month I buy a digital test, I waste my money. So I got one of the ones with the line. So anyway, I did it. She texted me in the morning, has your bleed come yet? I said, no, it's due today or tomorrow. She went, do a test, make sure you're negative so that I give you the right treatment. Fine. On the toilet, not thinking anything of it, looked down, a faint, and I mean really faint line. I thought, am I making this up? Am I like, you know, never. So never have Gareth and I had a spontaneous positive in 2.5, nearly 3 years. And so I sent a picture to Gareth. Does that look like a line to you? He didn't answer quick enough. So I sent it to another friend over here. I sent it to my mum, but of course, the UK is still asleep at that time. So I sent it to another friend over here. Does that look like a line? You know, holy F, she said, yes, it is. I thought, oh my God. Like, a lot of expletives got sent back. I just thought, what on earth? So I thought, right, I'll go for a beta. So I took myself to the lab, got a beta test. That's 4 hours to come back. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to buy a digital one now because my mind's playing tricks on me. And then digital positive. Could not believe it. Sent a message to my clinic in London, just had a positive pregnancy test, waiting for my beta numbers and my progesterone numbers to come back because I know the drill. And they sent back, oh, that's amazing. Got my beta number back, it was 9. And the first pregnancy I'd had, my beta number was 19 and it ended in a loss 5.5 weeks, chemical pregnancy technically. So I got the number 9 back and I messaged them, messaged my mum, messaged my friend. It's 9. I'm probably going to bleed in a week. False alarm. Everyone's going, oh, well, it might not be. Test again in 48 hours. So I said, fine, if I haven't bled, then I'll test. Told my acupuncturist. She did acupuncture to support pregnancy. And kept going back for beta tests every 48 hours. Started supplementing with progesterone and I was cross about it because I thought all these people are making me do blood tests, take progesterone and it's all going to be for nothing. So I was getting sort of cross with people for being positive about this positive pregnancy test. I'm thinking, ugh, everyone's just wasting my time. So telling me to do all these stupid things that's just pointless. So anyway, but I did it and I kept doing it and it kept being okay. And then I found myself at the 6-week scan and there's a yolk sac and it's in the right place. And they went back 5 days later, there's a heartbeat. And I'm just thinking, what? After all of this, what is going on? And in a good way, in a grateful, but what on earth? And still got the embryo sitting in the freezer in London.
Yeah. Gosh. And like that just must have been, you know, mind-blowing ultimately. Yeah. But the amazing news is that baby has stuck around.
They have.
And you are, like we said at the beginning, 21 weeks pregnant, I know. Which is just incredible. How has the pregnancy been? And yeah. you're still coming to terms with it a little bit.
Every day I still say to Gareth, I'm like, can you believe I'm pregnant? He's like, well, yes, we're over halfway. I can, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Like, how has it been? And I ask you this on a couple of different levels. And one is something that we have talked about on the podcast before and with other guests. But having been through the loss with Willow and, like, tell us a little bit about going through that NIP test again and getting like the milestones of 12 weeks, that kind of thing. And something else that we haven't covered on the podcast before, but is that something you share very openly is that you're bipolar. Before we started recording, you shared that actually you haven't been able to take the medication through the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So you're dealing with all of these emotions, you know, which are unusual and, you know, kind of just big, you know, for want of a better word, whilst not being medically supported in a way that you would have been in normal quote unquote life. There's a lot there. I appreciate
it's a lot. It's a lot. I mean, I'll speak to the loss part first. It's the thing with pregnancy after loss is you are purposefully putting yourself back in the very place that the trauma happened, in exactly the same circumstances almost. A lot of times you're visiting the same doctors, the same clinics, the same scanning rooms. It is a lot. And there's no easy way to get through it other than to get through it in whatever way you feel helps you best. And it's different for everyone. For me, the hardest points were doing the NIPT, waiting for the results, because even if the results are good, you spend so long building yourself, bracing yourself is the right word, bracing yourself for the worst news, because people around you go, I just know it's going to be okay. I just know this is the time it's going to be okay for you. And you sit and you think, how do you know that? You don't know that, because when you've lived the worst, you know that nothing's guaranteed. So words like that are really unhelpful. I find that it's the people around you that can destabilize you the most, actually, with their forever positive pants, you know, just not helpful, because you just think, well, you haven't got a crystal ball. You're not a doctor. You don't know. It's easier for you to say to someone, I really hope that this goes well. I'm here for you, whatever happens. That's actually really supportive and kind. Not, I just know this is going to be okay, because it just invalidates everything that you're feeling. So those are the things that make it hard. And then the obvious things like going through the same testing again and hoping for a different outcome. You feel like you're just blind and you can't speed up the process, because some of these tests can't be done till you reach a certain gestation, and you can't rush it. You can't just say, oh, well, make me 10 weeks now so I can have my blood test, and make me 12 weeks now so I can have my NT scan. You've got to just wait and carry on being pregnant until you get to that point where the baby is big enough to see or not see what's going on. So it's another sort of fairly powerless stage of limbo land that you just have to get through. So that was really difficult. The NIPT, getting those results was super, super hard, even though it was good results. And I'd say it took me about 24 to 48 hours to recover from receiving the good news, because it's hard for your brain to understand that there's been a different outcome. It takes a while to settle in. And then the NT scan, I nearly fainted in the waiting room waiting for the scan. I had to be taken into the nurse's room, put my feet above my head. I was like, oh, for God's sake. You know, just, but your body keeps a score, right? And there's no, you can't talk yourself or sensible yourself out of your feelings and emotions. You do just need the safety to feel them. And you need people around you who aren't going to make you feel stupid for having them, simply. So there's no easy way through. I don't have any advice, guys. Just, you know, surround yourself with safe people who aren't going to make you feel silly for feeling whatever you feel, and are strong enough to hear your fears without trying to fix it, and are just going to be there for you. That's the best support that I've had. And then you get through it how you get through it. So that's been the hardest thing. Physically, this pregnancy has been very easy so far. So with Willow, I was very sick. The first trimester, I was really not okay. I had really bad hip pain start at 8 weeks. I couldn't stand, sit, or walk without being in agony by the time I got to 12 weeks. And I was very sick in bed. I spent like 4 or 5 days in bed at one point. I've not had any of that this time. So physically, I've had a very easy time. It's just emotionally been challenging. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of the lost part, really. And now that we've had the anatomy scan, I feel much more reassured that, you know, many of the risk factors have kind of, we've got past those now. Mm-hmm. So I think for us, the anatomy scan was a good point of relief.
Yeah, good
mark. In terms of like the lost stuff. And I know there's other things that can happen, but the risk kind of gets smaller as you go along. Do you know what I mean? Sure. So like the huge risk factors, we've kind of eliminated some of the bigger risk factors now. So, you know, it helps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you been able to enjoy much, any of the pregnancy?
So it's always been both, right? All of it exists. Hope and fear exists simultaneously, and one doesn't negate the other. Just because you have fears doesn't mean you're not hopeful as well. Both are true, and that's okay. I think we live in a society where if you're not 100% happy, then you're not being positive enough. And I think that's just really damaging to people's emotional well-being, because actually it's completely human to have all of your emotions exist at once. And that doesn't mean that you're a negative Nelly. It doesn't mean that you're not grateful. It means you're human, and that's all right. So I'd say that I've had all of them. For me, I've had to, when I was pregnant with Willow, I was so anxious that I had weekly scans, and it served me well. So what I've learned is each pregnancy is different. this pregnancy, 24 to 48 hours before the scan, I get quite anxious, and then it takes me 24 hours to recover. So if I was having weekly scans, I'd lose 3 days a week,
yeah,
just in the build-up and the recovery. So I've decided for me this time, it doesn't serve me so well. So now I'm quite happy to have, I was having week, then it went to 2 weeks, then 4 weeks. So now I'm having a scan every 4 weeks, and that's enough for me because of the build-up and recovery time that it takes me to feel balanced again, which will bring us on to kind of the next thing with bipolar, is balance is, and feeling stable is important. So I have in between felt relief. I felt like, oh, I get a bit of a holiday from medical kind of stuff, which is less activating, so more calming for me. But I understand it's different for everyone. So you've just got to work out what brings you more relief. Is it bringing you more stress or relief, and kind of go with that, whatever that is for you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, every pregnancy is different, and we are all individuals. So, and even if we have multiple pregnancies, as you've talked about, they are different for the same person.
Yeah.
So we do have to work out what works for us.
Yeah.
With regards to the bipolar, like, had you come off your medication when you were trying, or were you on it? And again, people will be on different medication for different reasons, but in your circumstances.
So for me, the medication that works best for me, I was told years ago that if I wanted to conceive, I wouldn't be able to be on it, and I would need to come off it 3 to 6 months before I was ready to try to conceive, to make sure it's fully out of my system, because it can lead to babies that have deformities because the medication is incredibly strong. So I had already come off that when we knew that we were ready to start trying for family. I'd weaned off it over a few months. By the time we went to see that doctor and we then had the 3 month prep, I was already off it. And then I was, you know, so I had like a 6 month period where I came off it. And I'm looking forward to the day that I can go on the medication I know works for me, honestly. Sure. I feel like I've been white knuckle riding through the last few years to stay well. And with my medication, life's easier. Without it, I have to work twice as hard just to stay, and I'm going to do it in air quotes, you can't see me guys, but normal. Not that I believe normal exists anyway, but to feel stable. And it's hard work without it. I have to really work hard every single day to think, was that reaction and response that I just gave appropriate to the situation? Or is it because I'm off? Is how I'm viewing that how it really is? Or is it distorted because of the fact that I live with bipolar and it can distort the way you see things, hear things, perceive things? So I really have to do a lot of self-reflection. Now, before we started trying for family, I was in a job. My life was more than full, too full. I was one of those people that was too busy for life and prided myself on it. And I've had to adopt a whole new way of life. So I was in a job where I flew every single week internationally for work. I worked, you know, from 6, 7 a.m. till 9, 10 p.m., 6 days a week. I'd also work at weekends. And there is no way I would have room for that in my life, plus fertility treatments, plus what I now know is the loss that we've gone through as well. There was just no way. So I had to make a decision to change my life. So I went to part-time work, which meant financial sacrifice. People talk about the cost of IVF, but the cost for IVF for us was also my income as I knew it. And so, you know, I'd hate to add it all up, you know, terrifying.
I did a few years ago, and it's like ours is £50,000 thereabouts for treatment. But in total, and like I say, this was a few years ago now, it was £250,000 financial deficit, because it was about those loss of earnings. And not, you know, so, and like I said, God knows what it is now in theory. And, you know, who's to say if I got pregnant, you know, kind of spontaneously right at the beginning, that I would still be in a career that I was in, and, you know, who knows? But yeah, I hear you.
Yeah. Ultimately. You wouldn't be in these long stretched periods though of this suspenseful loss of finance, you know, which you know, yes, there would be financial losses. It wouldn't have been extended maybe as long as it has been for you and I don't think. So the impact is massive, right? It doesn't get spoken about enough, but it's there. And I feel grateful that we were financially privileged to do these things also. And I feel that's important to recognize. So it's, you know, gratefulness and loss all again. Here we go. Both exist. So I had to change my life. But aside from that, I had to change my life for my mental health, because if I didn't, I would have triggered myself to be very mentally unwell, because it's about capacity. I was already over my coping capacity with my current lifestyle. Go adding in IVF, lack of medication as I needed it, as was perfect for me at the time. My capacity is just going to overflow and my coping is going to max out. So I had to change my life to make space. I had to think, well, what can go? My bipolar, sadly, I can't just say, do you know what? I just don't want to have this condition for a couple of years. If you could just go away. So that's, I'm stuck with that, right? I'm stuck with the fact that I've got infertility. I didn't know how much loss was about to absolutely overwhelm us. The only thing that could change was my job and my life. Mm. And, you know, like I completely cut out alcohol. I never went out late. I was always in bed early. All these basics had to happen for me to have the coping capacity to get through this season of my life. And it's still the case now. So socially, I have to say no to an awful lot to stay well. Because if I give too much energy out, I just will become unwell. It's just as simple as that. And I feel like, you know, a lot has been sacrificed in those areas, but then I'm gaining others. And it's not forever. It's just for now, right? So we just have to be realistic about what we can actually cope with and what capacity we've really got for anything extra. And if we don't do that, we get unwell. Simple as that.
Yeah, that's so, like, you almost make it sound simple, but actually I think it's so hard to recognize our capacities, and especially in a world where it is almost looked upon as admirable when we are so mm-hmm. busy and so mm-hmm. you know, oh my goodness. But what actually happens, I think, so often is people say yes, because they feel bad saying no.
Yeah.
And then we get overwhelmed. And then, you know, and I kind of, like, I've done lots of work on that, on overwhelm, and then trying to bring that back and feel content, mm-hmm. but looking after yourself. And mm-hmm. and so, like, I know I can appreciate, and as lots of mm-hmm. people can, I'm sure, like, the work that has gone into that. And you're doing that to kind of, you're overcompensating in that because of your bipolar as yeah. well. You know, yeah. so that's a lot. And then you're having all of these big emotions.
Yeah.
Well, first off, you know, pregnancy hormones and things, but mm-hmm. then because of what you've been through before, the big emotions that come with that, and the anxiety mm-hmm. and the fear and the, you know, waiting for the results of the NIP test, you know, actually, mm. you know, waiting for scans and the come down from those. And like, that's yeah. just a roller coaster in its, like, hugest form, isn't it?
Yeah, it just requires an awful lot of managing. And I think that's been the key for me throughout all of this, is how do I manage this? And by managing this, that means that takes up my time, because it's like another job. So I have to make sure that I've made space to do this other job, because it is a job. Because if I don't do that well, then I'm not well, then everything falls apart, right? And then where are we? In a mess. So, and I know it's not forever. That's the bit that I have to keep telling myself, because if I don't remind myself of that, I can get very resentful, and you can get this entitlement thinking come through. Whereas, well, why should I have to give up this, this, and this when everyone else can do this, this, and this? Because at the end of the day, anyone living with a mental health condition, all you really want is to just be normal. And accepting that your normal looks different to other people's normal is hard and is grief and is loss. And I definitely had that battle for a long time, until I learned that I had to really respect my diagnosis. And I call it befriending bipolar. I had to befriend it. I had to accept that I had this housemate that had moved in, that I never asked for, that I never wanted, that I didn't need, I didn't really like, but yet I had to make friends with it, because guess what? It's not going anywhere. And I've got to respect the fact that this housemate likes things a certain way. And if I don't do it, they're going to cause merry hell. And I've just got to find a way to get on with it, coexist, cohabit. And if I don't, it's going to come and kick me in the, you know. So that's just where I got to. But I've been diagnosed 11 or 12 years, and it's taken me a long time and a lot of therapy and a lot of support and a lot of speaking to other people and a lot of trauma therapy, honestly, to work out what was part of my conditioning, my upbringing, and what's part of my condition, and which parts of my conditioning, my upbringing, trigger my mental health condition to become unstable, and vice versa. And it was only when I really got into the nitty-gritty of it that I started to understand this bit of my conditioned thinking is triggering me to think, feel, and act and react this way. And this is triggering my mental health condition to become unstable. And now I'm back into a period of being unwell. It's only once I really got into that stuff that I've managed to accept that my life does have to change. And I can't just keep pushing through and hoping that I can do what everyone else does and stay well. And I think that's probably where my biggest shift has come for me in this sort of journey of living with bipolar. Yeah.
You say that so eloquently. You really, really do. And my guess, if you don't mind me kind of making this kind of assumption, is that because of the work you had done previously, that has meant that you have been able to manage all of those emotions without medication whilst you've been trying and pregnant.
Absolutely. There's no way, if I hadn't done the work that I've done and been fortunate enough to cross paths with people that have shown me different ways to look at things, different things to try, because nobody gets well on their own. That's the other thing, right? So this isn't like Emma's just sat there and done it. Like, no. I believe healing happens in community. I don't believe we're designed to get through life alone in isolation. I think that makes everything worse because it makes us feel ashamed because we feel on our own because we believe that no one else is going through. Whereas the truth is, when we find a safe space and we realize, oh, I'm not the only one that thinks like that. I'm not the only one that's done that crazy thing. I'm not the only one that, you know, has had those dark thoughts. Shame goes, right? And then we've got space to do the work. And I believe that most of the work that we do is grief work. It's been my journey with bipolar has been grief work. My journey with sexual trauma recovery has been grief work. And then, of course, I got thrust into this area of IVF and baby loss. And so much of it is trauma and grief work. And I suppose I've just carried those things with me and they've served me well and enabled me to get through this in some type of fashion, which I'm grateful for. I'm not grateful for what's happened to me. I'm grateful for the tools I have that's helped me get through these things in some type of way.
Oh, honestly, you are so inspiring hearing you talk. You really are. And what you have done is not only support yourself, and, you know, I hear you when you say, you know, that hasn't been a lone effort, that there have been people around you. But now you've turned everything kind of outwards and you're supporting others. And there will be links in the show notes to TFMR Mamas, and, you know, you've got a podcast. You created the first TFMR Awareness Day as well, which you mentioned, I had missed this, apologies. But I, you know, you mentioned earlier on that that was on Willow's birthday.
Yeah, on what should have been her first birthday. So basically, before, as part of changing all my work, I started mentoring people who lived with bipolar. And I did it one-to-one, I did it in support groups, and I became an ambassador for Bipolar UK. And I've launched a podcast for them. The second series is going out right now. And I just love working with them. They were the first space where I first ever went to a support group a decade ago. And I was terrified. I thought I was going to walk in and, honestly, my words, I thought I was going to be surrounded by crazy people. And I was scared of these crazy people because I was scared what they might do to me, even though I had bipolar as well. I mean, it's such a mad way to think, but that's what I thought. I didn't know, I had never met anyone that had bipolar, and it was quite stigmatized, you know, over a decade ago. It's different now. Thank goodness. But, you know, when I got diagnosed, it was still quite heavily stigmatized. Even just having depression and anxiety was really, you know, there was a lot of stigma around it. There still is, but it's better. And I walked in and everyone was doing their shares, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I was so nervous. And then someone shared something, and I thought, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm going to be okay here. And I shared something that I'd done, which was way, like, not okay. And I was very ashamed of it, and I was very scared what people would think. And I shared it, and I looked up, had my head down because I was so worried about sharing it. And as I looked up, people were nodding, going, oh, happens. And I thought, I have found my people. This is amazing. Anyway, and I always said that, you know, when I got to a place where I was stable, I wanted to give something back, because Bipolar UK was just my first step into community and feeling safe and not feeling alone and isolated. So to be able to give back in that space is just, I'm so grateful that they have me. I'm so grateful for every bit of work that I do with them. And I love that it helps other people. So I then started mentoring people one-on-one, support groups, and also with women's trauma recovery and with women in the States. And when TFMR happened to us, and I say happened because it can happen to anyone, this tragedy, I was looking for a support group like the ones I run, where you teach daily tools to help, you know, and have a daily check-in and things like this. And I couldn't find exactly what I was looking for. There is support out there. There was and still is. It was forums. It was linking someone with an email to someone, a phone number with someone. But I really wanted something that was more like immersive. And I couldn't find exactly what I was looking for. So I put out a message on my stories and said, you know, are there any TFMR mamas out there that would want to, you know, if I put on some support group spaces, would you like to come? And I just got completely influxed by people, and I ran 10 support groups in a month, and they were all full. And it just started from there. And basically, it's just grown from me sharing excerpts from my, like, my diary as it was happening, because I was sharing my fertility journey real time. I just kept sharing. And then I set up TFMR Mamas, the page, and I started sharing like little snippets of my thoughts as it was happening. And now it's a not-for-profit in the UK, and it's just grown.
Amazing. Gosh, honestly.
So, yeah.
You are.
I feel very lucky.
Well, and to be able to say that after everything you've been through is extraordinary. It really is. I'm just going to ask you, just as we come to the end of our conversation, I feel like we could talk for hours, I really do. But how are you feeling, like, looking ahead now to the rest of your pregnancy?
So we desperately hope that this is the baby that gets to come home with us. And if we were to be really ambitiously hopeful, we hope that this baby comes home and that the embryo in the freezer in London is a chance at a sibling. I mean, that would just blow our wildest dreams. I very much, just to even say that out loud feels just, I just cannot believe where I'm at. I'm so grateful, so thankful that we've got this chance and another one. I just cannot believe how lucky we are. I just wish those chances for everybody. That's what I wish for us and everyone. I just wish everybody gets those chances. Yeah.
Oh, Emma, everyone listening, and I'm right here with them, are hoping that is exactly what happens, and we'll be following your story. Like I said, I'll put all the links so people can come and find you and find out more about the work you do in the show notes. Thank you so much for
sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's a bit like blows my mind. I'm on a podcast that's finally pregnant, you know, like, so thank you for having me too.
it's been so lovely
to talk to you.
Really lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah.
So much, and do stay in touch.
I will. Okay.
Take care. Bye bye.